It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we meet Cary Elwes, the Princess Bride star, otherwise known as the Man in Black.
First, Republican lawmakers introduced a bill yesterday that would curtail John Doe investigations, making it harder to use them for most investigations into political wrongdoing.
The new bill comes on the heels of two John Doe probes in the past 5 years, one that investigated Governor Scott Walker's time as Milwaukee County Executive and another that looked into allegations of illegal Walker campaign activities.
While Democratic lawmakers say the bill is a Republican attempt to protect politicians, Representative David Craig, one of the Republicans who sponsored the bill, says it's intended to avoid political misprosecution and protect free speech rights.
Patrick Marley joins us now. He's state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
How would the state's existing John Doe law change under the provisions of this new bill from state Republicans?
It would be limited to only the most serious felonies and certain violent crimes. Many other crimes currently there's no limit on what types of crimes you can use the John Doe law for. So that's one limit. Another is that you couldn't use special prosecutors in these cases. You couldn't use reserve judges to oversee them, and they couldn't last for more than 6 months without the approval of a majority of a group of 10 judges. And they couldn't, if they launched a John Doe and started finding a crime they didn't expect or began to suspect a crime that they hadn't anticipated, they would have to go to that same panel and get approval to expand the John Doe investigation.
And right now, as I understand it, witnesses and targets of an investigation can't share details about this with anyone but their lawyers. How would that change?
Right. So the law as it's constructed now, and it's a very old law, it's been in place since before Wisconsin was a state, was passed in the 1830s, says that the judge who oversees these investigations can put secrecy orders in place. Commonly that happens, so it's not required. And so for this recent John Doe had a very broad secrecy order that said nobody could talk to anyone but their attorneys. This new bill would prohibit that and say that only the prosecutors and judges, officers of the court, could be put under the secrecy orders, but those who are being investigated or those who may have witnessed crimes could not be put under secrecy orders.
So how could that changing secrecy aspect affect the way that an investigation unfolds, say?
Well, the reason that they have the secrecy orders are for two reasons. One is, you know, this is an investigation. It's not a criminal proceeding. No one's been charged. They're trying to find out if anything has gone wrong. And so they've wanted to have them done in secret so that the innocent are protected, right? If the prosecutors go in and they look into something and they find out that nothing illegal happened, they don't want people's names drugged out in a public process. The other reason is that you don't want witnesses talking together and coordinating their testimony so that they can say, hey, I got a call from an investigator and I've got to go in for an interview and let's make sure that we agree that I was here at this place at this time. Now, opponents of this say, one, it's a violation of free speech rights to put those kinds of limits. If somebody wants to talk about it in an investigation, they can. And the other big criticism is that sometimes when you're dealing with high-profile people, details of an investigation get out, they get thrown out in the media, the newspapers start reporting about them, and the targets who believe that they're innocent aren't able to defend themselves in public.
Is Wisconsin's John Doe law usually seen or sometimes seen as a violation of free speech?
Well, there's been a lot of litigation over this particular investigation that's involved Governor Walker's campaign. I think there's a half dozen or more lawsuits that have been filed in state and federal court. One of those cases went up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, a federal court, and they weren't addressing this secrecy issue on point on that day, but Judge Frank Easterbrook made an offhand comment that appeared to be, quote, screamingly unconstitutional. So there have been a lot of legal questions about whether Wisconsin's law goes too far in that regard.
So with this new bill, it would only John Doe could only be used for serious investigations and violent crimes. So for the other things that don't fall under those umbrellas, how would investigations be conducted?
Well, you know, prosecutors and investigators look into all kinds of crimes all the time without opening John Doe investigations. They just, you know, send cops out and have them go interview people and pick up evidence. So the authors of this bill say that's one way they could investigate these other crimes. And the other thing they can do is use the grand jury law. Most states don't have a John Doe law. They have a grand jury law. similar to what we have in the federal system, where you convene a panel of citizens that prosecutors present evidence to, and then they can make charging decisions. Wisconsin does have a grand jury law, but it is almost never used because it is much easier for prosecutors to use the John Doe law, and the John Doe law is a little more powerful. So the Republicans and others who have concerns about the John Doe law say they should use a grand jury because there's more of a check, in their view, because you have a citizen panel that's looking at the evidence as it's produced.
Overall, why would you say the lawmakers who introduced this new bill believe that a John Doe investigation is the wrong vehicle for investigation of political wrongdoing?
Well, this has all come under this heavy scrutiny and criticism because of this investigation of Governor Scott Walker and his and groups that supported him during the recall. I shouldn't say the governor's campaign and groups that supported him. There were concerns among prosecutors that they had violated some campaign finance laws and worked together in ways that they should not have. That investigation has been stopped for about a year because the judge who oversaw the investigation found that the activities that were being questioned were not illegal, and there's now a fight that's going to go to the Supreme Court to decide what happens next. But people on the side of the governor really feel very strongly that this investigation got out of control. They are concerned that it had a partisan taint to it, and they just think this secrecy in particular is a problem and that they need to change the law.
And Patrick, just briefly as we wrap up, what's next for this bill? How would it likely to proceed?
Sure. It was just made public yesterday. It hasn't actually formally been introduced, so right now lawmakers are signing on to it. It'll get introduced, I would guess, later this month, and then it'll go to a committee in each of the houses. They'll have hearings. They'll probably make some modifications to it because that almost happens with any bill. Then it would need to be passed by both houses of the legislature and signed into law by Governor Walker.
Patrick, thanks a lot for coming on and talking about it with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, state government and politics reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's also the co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, you may not have caught The Princess Bride in the theater when it first came out. Most people didn't, but chances are you're one of the many, many people who've seen it since then on DVD or videotape afterwards.
After a slow start, The Princess Bride has picked up steam and gone on to be recognized as a classic. Part fairy tale, part love story, part comedy, its all-star cast featured Mandy Patinkin, Billy Crystal, Christopher Guest, Robin Wright, Andre the Giant. It was directed by Rob Reiner. Here's a bit from the movie with future Princess Buttercup falling in love with farm boy Wesley.
Farm boy, fill these with water. Please.
As you wish.
That day she was amazed to discover that when he was saying, as you wish, what he meant was, I love you.
That was Cary Elwes as Wesley, also known as the Man in Black. When he landed that part, Elwes had no idea how the part would change his career and his life. He writes about the making of the movie in his new memoir called As You Wish, Inconceivable Tales for the Making of the Princess Bride. Cary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
We're a couple of years past the 25th anniversary of The Princess Bride. How does it feel to be the guy who brought to life The Man in Black and what's now clearly one of the classic movies of our time?
Well, it's an extraordinary feeling, I must say. I think I can speak for everyone involved in the film when I say how blessed we feel that the film has now taken off and become so beloved, you know?
Well, take us to that first meet and greet with Rob Reiner when you knew you were up for this part of Wesley. What happened?
Well, I was in Berlin, Rob, at the time. I was shooting an independent film in Berlin, and I got a call from my agent at my hotel, and she said, Rob Reiner and his producing partner, Andy Scheinman, are planning on flying to Berlin to meet with you to discuss the role of Wesley in The Princess Bride. Now, I knew obviously, I knew who Rob was from All in the Family and Spinal Tap, but I also knew about The Princess Bride because I'd read the book when I was 13 and loved it. So I knew what a big deal it was for me. It would be my first big American movie, although it was shot in England. And I adored Rob. I mean, I don't know about you, but I thought Spinal Tap was absolutely brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was very hopeful, obviously, and very fortunate that we hit it off right away. And the rest is history, as they say.
It almost didn't happen, though, right? That meeting, because they were jittery about Chernobyl, which had just happened recently.
That's right, Veronica. You're right. You're absolutely right. So while I was shooting in Finland, actually, that's when Chernobyl happened, and there was a warning by the State Department and by the authorities that it would be unwise, I think was the word they used, to fly to anywhere in Europe or Eastern Europe at that time. We were only 800 miles away when we were shooting in Finland from the site where it happened. But luckily for me, Rob and Andy decided to brave the elements and come and see me anyway. So yes, fortunately they came. They might not have, and therefore I might not be sitting here talking to you right now. So very fortunate.
You ended up there. You had this amazing cast assembled. What was the first read-through like in the room with, you know, Mandy Patinkin, Robin Wright, Christopher Guest, and everybody?
It was great. It really was. Andre, who was at first turned down the role because he was very insecure about his English accent, because he has a very strong French accent. But Rob convinced him by telling him he would put all his dialogue down on cassette tape, and gave these tapes to Andre, who showed up in rehearsals with a little tiny Walkman, which looked even tinier on, you know, the headset. It looked like tiny little toothpicks, little peanuts in his ear. And he learned his lines phonetically from listening to Rob do all his dialogue. So it was extraordinary. We knew then and there, even just the table read, that there was something kind of fun going on. I'll never forget during rehearsals, Mandy, during the sequence where he is discovered by Andre drunk in the forest by the Brute Squad, he actually slapped Andre during rehearsals. And I don't think anyone's ever slapped Andre in the face before. And there was sort of a stunned silence in the room of people thinking, oh my gosh, what's going to happen now? And Andre laughed, because for him it was like feeling a tiny insect bite or something, you know. But yeah, we had an amazing time. I wrote the book really as a love letter to the fans, because myself and the rest of the cast always get asked, was it as much fun making the film as it looked? And I wanted to share with them just how much fun we really did have making it.
It sounds like that there was some friendly rivalry at play between you and Mandy Patinkin, who played Inigo Montoya. How did that play out when you were training for those amazing sword fight sequences?
Well, Mandy, when I first met him, after the read-through, we all went and had lunch together, and I sat next to him and said, so have you had any training in fencing or anything like that? And he said, no. So I took him at his word, but when I showed up at for the first rehearsals for our fencing sequence, he was already left-handed. And I said, wait a minute. I don't think this guy's being totally honest with you. It turns out he'd spent 2 months training in Connecticut with one of the best fencers on the East Coast so that he was already prepared to disarm me on the first day of rehearsal. So I had a lot of catching up to do.
So you were starting, I always assumed when I saw that movie, you both came into this with serious stage combat experience. No, we find out.
None,
so what was the training regimen like to get up to this amazing scene? Yeah. So how did it take to get from 0 to 60 and film one of the most memorable sword sequences in movies?
Thank you for asking. It was eight hours, 5 days a week in pre-production. And then once we started shooting, our trainers, who were wonderful trainers, Bob Anderson, who was an Olympic fencer for Britain in the 50s, and Peter Diamond, who they both worked on all the Star Wars films. They did all the lightsaber sequences. They were just off camera with swords in their hands. And every time Rob yelled cut, they would just grab us and we'd work sequence, you know. So we really worked very, very hard at it. It was pretty much took up most of our time while we were shooting.
And it wasn't easy. I mean, you may have expected that you know, it's fight choreography. It has to just look good. But it sounds like it was incredibly grueling. I mean, there was you learned some real skills. You didn't become a master swordsman, but you learned some stuff.
No, we sure did. Well, our trainers told us that we had to learn each other's parts as well. So we didn't just learn our own sequence. We had to learn our opponent's sequence as well. And the reason for that, they said, was that there was less chance of an accident happening on the set if you knew your opponent's moves as well. So I had to learn all my moves right-handed and left-handed, and then I had to learn all of Mandy's moves right-handed and left-handed. So it was double the workload. So, yeah, we we had our work cut out for us, that's for sure.
Well, with all of that, the most dangerous sword moment for you in the movie was Christopher Guest bumping you on the head with the handle of a sword.
That is correct. Poor Chris. He felt so bad about it. We had real swords on the set. We didn't have any stunt doubles. And by that, I mean, for those folks listening, that a stunt double sword is a rubber one where you can, and it's painted to match the original, and so they use it for stabbing and things like that. Well, this sequence, he was supposed to knock me out in that moment in the forest where I question his six fingers, and he just hits me with the butt of his sword. Well, we didn't have a standby prop sword that day, and every take that he did, the camera operator, after cut, would turn to Rob and say, you know, we're not selling it, it's not looking real. And so me and my big mouth, I opened it and said to Chris, why don't you just tap me lightly? Famous last words. Yeah, why don't you just tap me lightly and see how that looks? And I woke up in the hospital. You know, so that shot that's in the movie of him knocking me out is actually me passing out from
wow.
God bless, and Chris hitting me with the butt of a sword. So,
did he feel guilty afterwards?
Oh, terribly, terribly guilty. And what's so funny is that the doctor in the hospital, I had to go to the hospital, obviously, in full makeup, and I was in my costume. And when I came to, the doctor said to me, you're very accident-prone, aren't you, Zorro? and so, you know, it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun. We really did. There was some clumsy moments on my part, but for the most part, we really had a great time.
Well, we can't let you go without talking some about William Goldman, who wrote the book and the script. And he, it sounds like, was really invested in the outcome of this. He really cared about this. Why was The Princess Bride so precious to him?
I know. It seems extraordinary in hindsight when you look at the body of work of this incredible writer. I mean, this is the man who brought us Marathon Man, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, and yet this is his favorite book. It's his favorite script. It's his favorite movie now of his work. And the reason for that is that he conceived of the idea for his daughters. He was on a road trip to California with his two little girls in the back of the car. And he asked each of them, he said, I'm going to write a book for you guys. What do you guys want it to be about? And one daughter said princesses and the other said brides. So it was a very personal, it was a personal film, a personal story for him, yeah? And he was terribly nervous. The first day he came down to the set, the first day shoot we had was the fire swamp where I'm putting the fire out on Buttercup's dress. And he missed the safety meeting and the whole thing. He arrived late and had no idea what we were shooting. And after Robin's dress caught fire, he forgot what was going on, and he yelled out in the middle of the take, oh, my gosh, she's on fire. Robin Wright is on fire. And he used words I can't use on the radio. And Rob yelled cut and turned to him and went, Bill, she's supposed to catch fire. He wrote it in the last 9 drafts of the script, even in the book. You know, I mean, he was mortified, poor guy, and removed himself from the set immediately. But, he was deeply, deeply invested in the film and stayed for half the shoot, which he normally doesn't do. He doesn't like to be around to shoot.
Before we let you go, Princess Bride is a heavily quotable movie. Reports this year that Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers quotes Princess Bride all the time in the locker room. Is there a favorite line or two that's just become part of your built-in vocabulary?
Yes. Let me just say this, by the way. After meeting Aaron and finding out what a fan he was of the film, I became an instant Green Bay fan myself, obviously, and lost as many fingernails as many folks did a few weeks ago, and I got to tell you, he's an incredibly wonderful human being and obviously an extraordinary talent. And we'll get him next time, guys. We'll get him next time, that's for sure. Yes, it's one of those incredible films that it has probably one of the more quotable lines than up there with Casablanca and Wizard of Oz. It's really extraordinary, and that's a testament to Goldman's writing. I have it easy. I always have, you know, women ask me to say those three words, which I always comply with, but Wally Shawn has it tough. You know, if he misses an elevator or something, someone yells at him inconceivable. he gets it almost every day, you know.
Thank you, Cary, so much for joining us, and I hope you enjoy your trip to Wisconsin.
I can't wait, and I really appreciate it. I was hoping that this would happen while Green Bay was playing at Lambeau Field so I could come out there and watch a game. But I'm happy at least to come and be a cheesehead in the land of cheeseheads. You know, I'm hoping that everyone will come out and join me for our event. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
That was actor Cary Elwes. He played the man in black, Wesley, in the classic movie The Princess Bride. His new memoir is As You Wish, Inconceivable Tales from the Making of The Princess Bride. You could see him tonight at the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison at 6:30 for a screening of the movie and a short talk with Veronica and me afterwards.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday, and since tomorrow is Valentine's Day, we thought we'd sweeten things up a bit and talk desserts.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite Valentine's Day dessert? Are you planning a special meal for someone this weekend? Call in and share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
So if you're even just now realizing that tomorrow is Valentine's Day, don't panic. We've got you covered. You have an opportunity here to surprise your loved one with a tasty treat.
Shannon Berry is a pastry chef and pastry manager at Batch Bakehouse in Madison. She joins us now to talk about making sweet things for your sweet thing on Valentine's Day. Shannon, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Hello, thank you.
So how did you first get into making pastries?
Well, I first started when I became employed at Batch, actually. I was a line cook before that.
So what do you like about making the sweet stuff now? You brought in, I should say, a couple of beautiful, beautiful looking, I think they're cherry pies, and they look delicious. What is it that appeals to you about making stuff like this?
I think the detail work is really what brings me in.
What do you mean by the detail work?
Just like you see the lattice and the hard topping, there's a lot of, you take your time when you work with pastries.
It should be beautiful, right?
Right, exactly. It's very technical, take your time, and I think I really enjoy that.
So I'm not a detail-oriented guy. Is it still possible to make a good, presentable pastry dessert if you're not that finicky and not doing that kind of lattice work and things like that?
Oh, definitely. Because when you're working with butter and sugar, you know it's going to taste good. And people love things that taste good.
What does it take to make something that tastes good? I mean, what's the difference between a flop and something that's actually, you know, something your loved one is going to go, yay?
I think probably proportion is what it is, and that's the science behind baking, is definitely proportion. Flour versus leavening, how many eggs, and then how much sugar to kind of balance that out. But yeah, it's once you get the proportion down, it's not too bad.
Do you use recipes, or are you one of those who can just go into the kitchen and create and eyeball the flour, eyeball the sugar, and just go from there?
We do use recipes at the bakery, and once I think I found once you have a base recipe, you can kind of work with it a little bit. You know, once you have a pie shell that you enjoy, a pie crust you enjoy, the flakiness or what have you, then you can kind of work with the filling and see maybe what kind of flavors. Like, I prefer tart flavors. I really like the cherry pie. It might be my favorite we have. And then as apples go for pies, I prefer Granny Smith because they're very, very tart.
Well, let's talk about how we do something like the pie. Are these pies or tarts?
These are pies.
Okay. So let's talk crust first of all. What is the key to making a good pie crust, maybe for the novice, the amateur?
I would say cutting the butter is what you need to probably know. Because what butter is it's butter, fat, milk solids, and water. And so if you cut the butter in well, You'll get the flakiness because as it cooks, the water will steam away, and that's what kind of creates the pockets of flake.
And I have a problem sometimes. I'll want to, when I try to soften butter, I over soften it or even melt it a little in the microwave. I have heard that's a mistake. That's going to ruin your pie.
Yes. Yeah. I would definitely recommend colder butter. And then once you mix it, you got to be patient. Put it in the fridge for at least an hour, I'd say. If you can do overnight, that's probably better. It just works a lot better when it's cool.
So you mentioned making sure that you've got cold butter. I mean, there's a science to this, but what does the cold butter do that the melty butter doesn't?
Well, it's together. All the ingredients are combined. So then when you actually put it in the oven, you're going to actually steam out the water. Where when it's already warmer, it's kind of already done that. The water's already... The condensation has gone off, and you're losing a little bit of that.
Now, let's get to that filling now. We've got cherries here. You like the tart fillings. What kind of fruit should we be looking for when we're shopping and just trying to put together a good tart pie?
Oh, man, I'd say for tart, cherries are the best. Like I said, I think Granny Smith apples are good. In the summertime, I think peaches are fantastic for pies.
And we do have a recipe for this mini cherry pie, the one you brought in, and I'm looking at, it's tantalizing me over here.
How long are we going to keep looking at that?
Rob's wanting to start eating it. Well, the recipe for it is up on the Central Time Facebook page. This is something you can still pull off in time for Valentine's Day, right? This is not going to eat your whole night. This is something you can still do.
Yes.
How long does it take to pull off one of these mini cherry pies?
Probably maybe 2 hours, maybe.
You could probably
push it, yeah. But I'd say about 2 hours.
And I noticed serve them in these little aluminum tins. Is that something we need?
Mini
it's
pies.
Not something I have at home, but is that what you need to use to pull these off?
I think that's probably your best choice. And I think you can find them in most grocery stores. They're pretty convenient, easy to use. Yeah.
Veronica, do you want hearts or lattice before I start biting into one of these here?
The lattice one looks really
okay.
good.
All right, I'll take hearts.
And I know you have a heart t-shirt on. No, you don't.
What? Sure. Yeah, why not?
Thank you
for bringing
these. It's
under the sweater. So, are you going to... All right, I'm gonna eat first. You talk, I'll eat.
Sure, I
ha ha.
So you use Door County cherries in these pies.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something special about the Door County cherry that you like?
Well, they're Wisconsin based, which is awesome. And then they're red tart pitted cherries, which is what we go for. So we know that they're the tart cherry rather than the sweet cherry. And they preserve them in a little bit of sugar, which is nice. So then they're kind of already sugared. For us.
Anything else that goes into these? They're already, we've got some sugar in there. What else goes into this pie?
So we add a little bit of lemon zest, which I really like because, again, it adds
it
a little
it
more.
Perks it up a little, right?
Yeah, tartness, a little freshness. And then we had a tiny bit of almond extract, which kind of rounds the flavors out. I like that, too.
Is Rob still chewing?
I'm still chewing. No, I'm good. A lot of times the fresh fruit you want isn't necessarily available. Can we do frozen in a pinch or canned mixes?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Anything we do differently if we're using non-fresh fruit? Oh, Veronica's trying the lattice one now.
Usually frozen fruits juice a lot more, so you might want to add a little more cornstarch or even a little flour when you toss those, when you put them in the actual shell.
How is it? Mine was really good, and I bet yours was just as good. Tell us in great detail how that was. So how about non-pie desserts? If we want to break away from pie land and try some other things, what are some good, again, easier to accomplish things that somebody might try tonight or tomorrow morning for their Valentine's Day feast?
Well, sugar cookies and cupcakes are always fun. You can always shape them like hearts or write on them, decorate them in a fun way, things like that. And then we have cheesecakes. Cheesecakes are very sexy, right? Creamy, very good. I'd love cheesecake. And then we have a chocolate cake, a flourless chocolate cake, which is a little more complicated, but it's really delicious, really rich. Good for two people, too.
So a lot of people, when they want dessert and it's Valentine's Day, they do want chocolate because there's something about chocolate that just feels a little more, I don't know, rich,
decadent,
voluptuous, all that good stuff. So what do you recommend for working with chocolate?
Well, there's a lot of ways to work with chocolate. But I'd say if you want to do like a fondue type thing, or even it's pretty easy. Let's say you weighed out like 3 cups of dark chocolate, which I think the quality of the chocolate can make a difference as well, and added maybe 2 cups of cream and melted that slowly together and mixed it, you'll have melted chocolate, you know, and yeah, the cream makes it even smoother, and you can dip strawberries, whatever you want, in that. So that's another simple way to enjoy chocolate.
Oh, that sounds easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, you said quality matters. Do you recommend a particular brand?
Oh, man.
I've only heard of two chocolate brands, Valrhona and, besides Hershey.
Yeah.
Scharfenberger. Do I have that right? Barker or something like that?
Oh, man. I don't know. I prefer dark. I guess I'd go like that. Some people really like milk. Like my mother just loves milk chocolate, and I love dark chocolate. So that depends on what you like as well, how bitter you like it. So I don't know. I know I like Ghirardelli. I know that's kind of a national brand,
right?
But I do like Ghirardelli a lot.
So make the case for making our own dessert as part of our Valentine's Day festivity, as opposed to the usual box of chocolate covered cherries or whatever.
Well, I think that a lot of people on Valentine's Day, it's a thought that counts, right? And so I think if you make someone a dessert, it comes off more like that, more heartfelt, even if it can come off as a disaster, and then you have a funny story, too, And so I think that would be my case, is that it's just like anything else that's more heartfelt instead of going out and buying, which isn't a bad thing. Maybe making your own is, it takes a little more time, effort, get your hands a little dirty. I think people appreciate that.
Now, you've been at Batch a couple of years. What are the biggest sellers on Valentine's Day?
On Valentine's Day? Man, the ham and gruyere croissants, no matter what we do. Just fly
the traditional
off.
Valentine's ham croissants.
Well, that's pretty much all me, though, so.
I see. That's why. I think our flowers chocolate cake, we sell, people order the 6-inch ones. We sell a lot of those. And then we make a lot of heart-shaped, we call them shorties. So they're shortbread cookie stacks that we put buttercream and we decorate with buttercream and chocolate curls and chocolate and whatever, and those sell. Mm. Those sell a lot, especially holidays and Valentine's Day.
We're talking to pastry chef Shannon Berry right now about dessert ideas for our Valentine's Day sweethearts, parties, solo celebrations, you name it. Some great dessert ideas for the holiday.
And we're taking your calls. What are your favorite treats to make for that someone special in your life? Maybe on Valentine's Day, or if you like to go out, what do you like to order? What says a decadent, beautiful Valentine's dessert to you? You can call in, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our Food Friday discussion now about desserts with pastry chef Shannon Berry from Batch Bakehouse in Madison.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite dessert to eat? What's your favorite dessert to make? Do you have a go-to or one that's really been a winner on Valentine's Day? Maybe something that puts somebody over the edge, convince them, you're okay. Okay, I'll go out with you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or maybe you need some dessert baking advice. We'll take your calls for that, too. 800-642-1234. Or you can post at the Central Time Facebook page.
And you mentioned, Shannon, cookies as something that can be fun to do. I like to do that with my kids, make sugar cookies ahead of time, and then decorate them. Do you have any suggestions for making the decorating part a little more elegant and go more smoothly?
Oh, man. I don't know if I do. I think part of it's fun getting messy. I think I can give you some tips on what to use, maybe.
Sure.
We go between different frostings, buttercreams, and then easy glazes. For example, you mix powdered sugar and milk together. That's a really easy glaze. And you can kind of play with the proportions for what you want. And then you can just turn the cookie over, dip it right in, pull it off, and that will dry really nicely, really smooth.
Oh, so you actually dip the cookie in it.
Sure.
So you should put it in like a nice big shallow bowl and then dip.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, or you can use, they have like racks that you put over sheet trays, and then you could pour it over on the rack, and the cookie will stay above the rack, and all the glaze will go below, and then that'll look perfectly glazed. So
nice.
There's another one that we do.
As sugar cookies are nice and straightforward, any other great cookie ideas that we might turn to on Valentine's Day?
Oh, man. I'd probably go back to the chocolate. We have a wonderful cookie at the bakery called the Korova, and it's just chocolate on chocolate, and we salt it with sea salt, and it's great. It's a crowd favorite for sure.
What is it about, the salt and the chocolate together, or salt and caramel? Those are big and kind of a fad, but it's a great fad because it's awesome.
Yeah. Well, salt just brings out the flavor. And so I think with creamy things, it's nice. One, I think it cuts a little bit of the fat, which is nice, so it's not too creamy. But then it just adds to the flavor, which is good.
And in terms of, other add-ons besides salt, if you want to kind of juice up your chocolate cookies, what else would you think about adding?
Oh, man. I'd probably just drizzle more chocolate on top. I really
so add more chocolate. I'm a fan.
And then they do have a lot of decorative sugars, which is we use at Batch a lot, and that it's an easy way to just make something kind of sparkle.
What's a decorative sugar?
Which is fun. We use like a sprinkle sugar that we. I'm not exactly sure. I know the brand name
is it just the texture?
Sprinkling. It's a little bigger, so. The texture, so it's brighter, it's a little bigger than the granulated. You can't really see it. So it's basically like a larger granulate of sugar. Mm.
Let's bring our callers in. We've got Patty on the line in Wauwatosa. Patty, hi.
Hi. I've recently discovered that you can make some incredible chocolate cakes using flavored olive oil, like orange flavored or raspberry flavored. And I'm wondering if your guest has ever done anything like that.
Patty, before we let you go, Patty, what kind of things do you make with these flavored olive oils?
Well, so far, I've only made a chocolate cake, which is it's just got this wonderful orange chocolate flavor. Mm.
I think you're going to have to bring this by for us, Patty, so we can fully understand what you're working with. Patty, thanks for that. Olive oil in our desserts, is that something you've encountered?
Yes, definitely. The fat that you use really makes a difference in whatever cake you're using, and oils tend to make a cake very moist. And chocolate and orange go great together, so I could see how that would work.
Thanks for bringing that up, Patty. I've been intrigued by the olive oil cake before, but never quite had the gumption to try it. So appreciate that. We're going to go next to Vince, who's joining us in Rhinelander. Hi, Vince.
Hi.
What are you making?
Well, what I think will melt anyone's heart. You get those square pretzels, and you put a Hershey Kiss or a Rolo on it, and you heat it up for a little bit and melt it on top. You can make like 30, 40 of them per batch pretty easily.
Nice save for your sister who works there.
Yeah.
All right. That's a nice simple one. A Rolo or a Hershey's Kiss over a pretzel. Do you do that in the oven or a microwave? Or
I would probably do the oven. Yeah.
Nice. That sounds good.
Super simple. And ultimately, you're bringing a little crunch, that salt, and the chocolate together again.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, thanks, Vince. That's a great suggestion. That'd be easy enough. Even I could do it. Get my kids on board with that. I might try tomorrow. We'll go to another caller now. 800-642-1234 if you have a dessert suggestion or question. We've got Leland on the line now in La Crosse. Leland, hi.
Hi. You were talking about apple pies earlier, and I found that if you're making an apple pie with the Granny Smith, it's nice to put in some lemon and maybe a little bit of cloves, too.
Lemon and clove. Okay, so I would think that the lemon, Leland, would make it tartar with already a tart apple, but that doesn't spoil it for you?
No, it doesn't seem to be overly tart, and the cloves kind of help balance it out, giving it more of like a sweeter kind of undertone.
Leland, thanks. I'm intrigued. What do you think, Shannon?
I think that sounds great. I love Granny Smith apples in apple pies again. And we do, in our apple pies in Thanksgiving, we do clove and nutmeg and things like that as well. It does actually really balance it out.
A little clove can go a long way, though, as I recall.
Yes, a little clove. A little clove can go a very long way. You definitely have to be careful with the clove.
It reminds me of a story. Somebody in my family, everybody's together, was making a pie or something like that, and shook in, reaching for the cloves, grabbed the chives.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wait. It was they don't look anything alike.
No, but I mean, just the package. I don't know. Yeah. But they're right next to each other. Yeah. It was a family legend, the chive flavored sweet pie. It was not a winner.
That's a shame. It could have been something bold and new. Oh, well.
Ahead of its time.
Are there any kind of off the wall things that you add to pies, Shannon? We talked about cloves. We talked about lemon, which is pretty common. But any other things?
Man, off the wall
spices.
Things. We've discovered recently that cardamom and white chocolate go really well together.
That sounds good.
So we haven't added that to our pies yet, but a lot of our cakes have been working with that. And espresso, those three, they have a beautiful flavor together. So that's a little off the wall. I don't think a lot of people use cardamom in their baking, and it can
that's
add a
great
lot.
Idea. Hmm.
And I've thought, coffee and chocolate in the same desserts, but coffee and white chocolate I don't think I've run into before.
Yeah, it's actually really nice.
Hmm. Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Cass in Lake Geneva. Cass, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What have you got for our dessert tray here?
You know, my children love to make a coral la creme, and it's just a white chocolate with a little bit of cream cheese and heavy cream and confectioner sugar, and you plop it in a heart-shaped mold, line it with cheesecloth. let it set overnight, and to make like two different fruit sauces, like different colors, little yin and yang, and plop it on there, and they just love it.
So wait, cream cheese and white. So does it ultimately congeal, and you can add your own more appetizing word than congeal, but it ends up being a solid thing. I think we're losing Cass there, but I think we get the gist. So we're congealing white chocolate and cream cheese, and then a dessert
combining
topping.
Them, maybe. Combining. Yeah. I don't know about congeal.
Yeah, okay.
This dessert.
That doesn't capture the Valentine's Day spirit, huh? Two hearts that congeal is one. This is new to me. I don't think I've encountered a dessert like this, Shannon.
Me neither. I can't say that I have. It sounds very sweet.
Yeah.
It does sound
rich.
Good.
Yeah, I'm in.
Cream cheese is always a nice addition for things, mixing in things. I mean, you can almost add anything sweet to that. And
I love cream cheese.
Cream cheese and brownies I've always liked. That's really good when you get those. We've just got a few minutes left. Do you have dessert plans for this weekend? Something you're going to try making on your own or at the bakehouse that we haven't talked about yet?
I do not. I think we have a really good Valentine's Day menu. I'm really excited about it. So tomorrow, I mean, decorating, you know, all morning for everyone. So
nice. And anyone that's special that you'll be baking for, do people know that you work at the bakehouse and go, yep, we come on over to our house on Valentine's Day?
Oh, everybody tries that. Yeah, everyone.
Doesn't always work, huh? But your brother's bringing you the Rolo pretzel,
yes.
So you're set.
So I'm ready to go. Yeah.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for joining us. It was fun to talk about all these delicious options for Valentine's Day.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's been really fun.
We've been speaking here with Shannon Berry. She is the pastry manager at Batch Bakehouse in Madison. She was with us to talk about Valentine's Day desserts. And don't forget, we've got her recipe for Door County mini cherry pies up there on the Central Time Facebook page. Shannon says they don't take a lot of time, only a couple of hours to pull these things off.
Yeah, and you can still share your dessert favorites over there while you're getting that recipe.
A milestone coming up for movie buffs. This Sunday marks the 30th anniversary of a Generation X classic, The Breakfast Club.
It was directed by legendary director John Hughes. It starred most of the Brat Pack generation of the young actors of the time, including Molly Ringwald, Emilio Estevez, and Anthony Michael Hall.
I cannot overstate the importance of John Hughes movies in my coming of age era. Pretty in Pink loomed pretty large.
Yeah, those were big movies. Those are the ones that it seemed like it was a common cultural reference at the time. Everybody had seen it and maybe could identify with one of the Breakfast Club, you know, the smart guy, the jock, the like sort of stoner rebel guy. That was the boy side of things. Did you, Molly Ringwald or the other woman, I can't remember which actress it was.
It was always Molly Ringwald, okay. Or it was Ally Sheedy, I think,
was the one who was
in The Breakfast Club as well. But yeah, watching these movies, you can just, at least I can just smell the Clearasil. I just remember it so well.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it'd hold up today. Maybe I'll give it a try. We'll go out to the news with a hit song from the movie. It's The Simple Minds with Don't You Forget About Me.